A chill wind blows on a bleak night. The place, Washington, D.C., the capital of a divided nation. It has been a rain-filled April. Pennsylvania Avenue is awash with mud and muck. The city sleeps, but it's a mournful sleep. One of those who mourns is the wife of the President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated. This week, we observe the 100th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln. So let us go back 100 years ago and relive those days. Let us meet the people who walked in the shadow of Lincoln, some who loved him, some who hated him. Tonight, on part two of The Last Days of Lincoln, we meet the plotters. And history says they created the drama that rang down the curtain on the final hours of Lincoln's life. These are The Last Days of Lincoln.
The Last Days of Lincoln. This series is brought to you by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and your Lincoln Life General Agents in the Twin Cities, Lynn M. Elling and Associates of Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul, and by Twin City Federal, headquarters for savings accounts, home loans, and home improvement loans. Now, 100 years ago tonight, The Last Days of Lincoln.
The time is April, 1865, and the President of the United States has less than a week to live. Destiny has ordained that he shall not live out his second term, that he shall be assassinated. There have been many threats on the life of Lincoln. The president has learned to live with the possibility that his life could be cut short abruptly by the slash of an assassin's blade or the impact of a bullet. The Capitol, Washington, D.C., seems almost made to order for such an event. The city wears a veil of confusion. Riotous celebrants crowd the taverns, toasting the approaching end of the Great Civil War. Spies from both North and South do the last bits of their business. Con men and glad-handers look for opportunity. The war is fast coming to an end. The dead soldiers still lie in the woods and meadows. The lucky ones who returned walked, rode, and straggled into Washington. The town is a tumultuous backdrop for the events that will follow. And though the joy of the North grows with each passing moment, the gloom of the South deepens with each passing day. The news is both good and bad, depending on which side you're on. President Lincoln, who cannot know the mind of Providence, is on a fast treadmill into oblivion. And to whom has destiny given the task of fashioning this treadmill? His name, John Wilkes Booth, the leader of a motley crew who managed to stumble their way toward carrying out one of the greatest crimes in history. And so, who is this man, John Wilkes Booth? We must meet him if we are to understand the schemes that are created, each designed to claim the life of the President of the United States. Students of history, and this may be why that most of us, when thinking of the death of Lincoln, guide our thoughts to one diabolical plot. But it didn't happen that way. Booth and his men failed in more than one attempt to endanger the life of Lincoln. They succeeded in their final attempt. But history agrees that the center of each plot was none other than John Wilkes. He was dark-haired and handsome, a man for the ladies. John Wilkes was the 9th of 10 children, born to Junius Brutus Booth and his wife, Mary Ann Holmes. John Wilkes was named for the revolutionary Lord May of London, who cheered for Yankee Doodle in the War of Independence and helped many an American escape through the secret underground. He was the darling of an eccentric family, but overshadowed by the natural acting talents of his brother Edwin. His father, considered by many to be the greatest actor of his time, was also a drunkard. But John Wilkes Booth, never the actor that his brother or father were, was making $20,000 a year at the time he began planning his deadly plots. In Richmond, the Virginia capital, every other woman took notice of him. They chirped and screamed when he walked on stage, thronged after him in the street for his autograph. And at the height of this season, he liked to wear a claret-colored coat with velvet lapels, a fawn waistcoat, tight dove gray trousers with elastic heel straps, a bushel-sized straw hat, and he carried a bamboo cane. The Glass of Fashion, with kidnap and murder in his heart. While in Washington, John Wilkes Booth stayed at the National Hotel at 6th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. His nights were long and his parties were many inside this plush, well-upholstered building.
If I may speak truthfully, my friends, an actor I may be, but a gentleman I truly am. And not one of you can disprove this. Besides, with the times the way they be, who has time for disproving anyone? I may be a spy. Of course, I've no time for such undertakings. But then you may be a spy as well.
So, setting this aside then, John Wilkes, let us drink to our company. Call them spies, scouts, call them what you will.
This brandy's delicious. Did I ever tell you about my love for fine brandy? I can say without demerit that I was born for fine brandies. And fine ladies, too, if you will.
And of ladies you have many. But of brandy you can get not enough.
'Tis true, my friend. But then, which lasts the longer? The ladies or the brandy?
The raconteur, the madcap, the playboy. Known and celebrated, with money for both brandy and the ladies. John Wilkes Booth still had other things on his mind. And these things had been in his mind for a long time. Years before, John Wilkes was a comely, handsome schoolboy. He wore the gray of an artillery cadet and took to the field with his classmates at an academy to learn mathematics, moral philosophy, English grammar, and the manual of arms. One day, the boys were grouped around John, exchanging dreams of glory, as most young boys will do. But there was something different about John Wilkes, even at that age. He had hopes of doing something big, bigger than any man had ever done before. And so, he spoke to a classmate.
Think of the Colossus of Rhodes. Suppose that statue was now standing and by some means I should overthrow it. My name would never be forgotten. It would be in the history of all times and be read thousands of years after I'm dead. And no matter how smart and good men we may turn out to be, we would never get our names in so many history books.
But suppose the falling statue took you down with it. Then what good would all your glory do?
I should die with the satisfaction of knowing I had done something never before accomplished by any other man, and something no other man would do.
Two young boys, on a summer afternoon, chattering their daydreams away. But this case was different, for one of these boys was John Wilkes Booth, and his name was destined to live in history, but for nothing good. Later, Booth had thrown off the cloak of the young boy. He had acquired the grand manner and the wardrobe of a millionaire. He posed as the gentleman and the dasher, the Beau Brummel of the drawing room, dispensing romance and gallantry at every turn. He had a savage temper. His mind and wit were as sharp as a razor, and he never forgot what he set out to do. And by the second week in April, John Wilkes Booth had set out to remove the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, from this mortal world. But this job, independent though he was, John Wilkes could not accomplish alone. He had to have help. His ego had to be bolstered by a group of followers, and these he had no trouble in finding. And so we introduce Lewis Payne, 20 years old, but already at that age, a paroled Confederate soldier. Lewis Payne was a soldier. He had fought in the valley. He had fought in the plain. His two brothers died at Murfreesboro. He was a veteran of an ugly war, even at his young age. And Lewis Payne could be used in a plot against the president. He was a large man by any standards, tall, dark-haired, and brooding. His muscles and sheer strength could be used by a man such as John Wilkes, especially if Payne pictured Booth as an idol, and that's exactly what he did. Some historians say the young giant first met Booth at a theater in Richmond, Virginia, where Booth was starring in a play. True or not, the pair became companions. Booth, suave and sophisticated. Lewis Payne, big and boorish, but an attentive listener.
We're not so very much different, Lewis. We both want freedom for our country. The war is going badly. You might even call it a rout. But I still contend that one swift blow could turn the tide.
Well, this may be true, Mr. Booth, but who is left? We can't win the war now, even if we put to destruction the whole of Washington City.
I'm not talking about the destruction of Washington, my friend. I'm talking about removing a great menace to our freedom from this very city.
Oh, you mean Abe Lincoln. I'm no fool, you know. I've heard such talk before.
Well, it needn't be just talk, you realize. In fact, yours truly, John Wilkes, has been thinking about this for some time. I mean, some friends of mine and myself.
Then you're not alone in this thing?
Of course not, Lewis. It takes more than one valiant man to undertake such a task.
It takes more than one man, but the word valiant was supplied by Booth. It doesn't describe the men who took part in the plans. So let's examine another of the conspirators. His name, George Andrew Atzerodt. History paints him as a good-natured clod, a happy, scratching, dancing bear, carriage painter by trade, a drunken sot by character. George Atzerodt was born in Prussia. He came to this country at the age of 8. He was a drifter, an object of disgust to his entire family. He lived in Port Tobacco, Virginia, but drifted to Baltimore after a fight with his brother. He spoke with a German accent, loved his beer, and he was the type that made the perfect pawn for the deadly design of John Wilkes Booth.
Now, Winnie, just give me another, and I'll get these tired bones out on the trail and head for home. Ah, don't look so disgusted. It's early, you know. Isn't that right, pal? Huh?
Why do you have to act so loud? I'd give a Confederate shirt just once to hear you say something without spitting all over the bar.
Sure. Go ahead. Talk to George Atzerodt that way. Go ahead. It won't be too long before you'll be looking up to George instead of looking down at him.
You sound pretty sure of yourself.
And why shouldn't I be? Do you know who my friend is? He's John. John Wilkes Booth, the actor. And we've got plans, and plans, and plans, and you'll never guess what about.
Maybe you'll get on stage and they'll give you the part of a gorilla.
Sure, go ahead, make fun. You'd give every penny in your purse to know what I'm talking about. But I won't say no more about it because you wouldn't believe it anyway. Vinny, how about my beer? One more and I'm getting out of here. And maybe the next time you see me, pal, you'll treat me a bit different.
The only person who treated George Atzerodt a bit different, as he put it, was John Wilkes Booth. He knew how George could best be used. He would be used as the sacrificial lamb, given an impossible job to do, and then, because of his own dull-headedness, would easily be captured by the authorities. That impossible job would be to slay the Vice President of the United States, Andrew Johnson. And George, the fumbling fool, would not be up to it. But there were others in the Booth group of conspirators who were not fools. For example, there was Samuel Bland Arnold, 28 years old, another former Confederate soldier, now a commissary clerk at Fortress Monroe, Virginia. Sam Arnold, too, was caught up with the prevailing war fever. He was not below plotting. And so, with Lincoln's life hanging in the balance, the pair dined together at a fashionable Capitol night spot. Good cheer filled the private dining room as Sam Arnold, John Wilkes, and others talked over their plans. It was at this point that Arnold showed reluctance.
So you see, my good friends, it needn't be so complicated if we learn our duties well. Carry them off with dedication and precision.
But see here, John Wilkes, I can agree with you in principle, but that's all. You'll not catch me stalking into that damn theater with 1,000 idiots watching some play and expect me to kidnap the president under the eyes of them all. I wouldn't last for a half hour.
Without seeming impertinent, then, my dear friend, what does appeal to you? By what plan do you feel your soul can abide?
There's no need to sound so snippy about it. It's my neck, too, you know. I say we either capture him in the carriage when he goes to the old soldier's home, or you can count me out of it.
Sam Arnold, any man who talks of quitting should be shot. Do you hear? Shot!
Two can play at that game, you know.
what webs we weave. And this web, although not woven well, would in the end ensnare its prey. The victim, President Lincoln, was living the last week of his life. At this point, a modern mystery writer would tell us the plot thickened. And so it did, as John Wilkes Booth collected his conspirators. He had the big bull ox, Lewis Payne. He had the willing drunkard, George Andrew Atzerodt. He had Sam Arnold, the unwilling party, who would later disengage himself from the entire deal. Who else was needed? To Booth, the collector of conspirators, the answer lay with Davy Harold. He was a 23-year-old former drugstore clerk whose life would be jerked to a sudden halt at the end of a hangman's noose. He was a drifter, addicted to night owling and quail hunting. The Harold family were Marylanders who moved to Washington before the Civil War. The family upheld all the rules of Victorian respectability, but David Harold was the problem child. He had seven sisters and a mother to fuss over him. He hated it, but he stayed at home until he was old enough to make his own way. Why would a man like John Wilkes Booth, egotistical and cunning, pick a man like David Harold? The answer is simple. Harold was an expert with guns, and he knew the back roads of Virginia like the back of his hand. With that knowledge, he was and had to be an indispensable member of the Booth Brigade. Better still, he was loyal, and in particular, he was loyal to one man, the celebrated actor, John.
I told you, I could hit it like nothing. It don't have to be big or nothing. If I can see it, I can hit it. Like shooting ducks in the slough.
Davy, I gotta hand it to you. You're a right smart dead shot. But where's that gonna get you? You hunt the duck? Go after the quail and come home with rabbits once in a while? So what's it mean? I mean, what good's it do you?
Well, no good now, maybe, but it will later. I even met the president.
And that was no lie. The young man who had joined with Booth had met President Lincoln. It was routine, but it would stick in Davy's mind until he met with a rope.
Nothing special, guard. I work for Francis Walsh, the druggist at 8th Street near the Navy Yard. I've got a bottle of something for the president.
Sounds unusual, doesn't it? That the delivery boy from the pharmacy would stand outside the door of the president in the White House, holding a bottle of castor oil. But it actually happened.
Don't just stand there, son. Come right in. And tell me, what is your business?
Well, I'm from the druggist, sir, and I've got this bottle of castor.
Well, that's just grand. I won't ask you who it's for. Just give me the bottle, son. Castor, you say it is?
That's right, sir.
Fine, I'll take it and see that it gets to the right party. And say, if it would be no trouble...
No trouble at all, Mr. President.
Then maybe you won't mind if I charge this.
Lincoln thought it was a good joke, and it was, for the leader of a nation to have a bottle of castor oil charged at the corner pharmacy. It's ironic that young Davy Harold ever met President Lincoln face to face. Because, as destiny would have it, Harold would play a major role in the death of that very same man. But first, he had to meet John Wilkes Booth.
I met him off and on, sometimes once a week, or maybe two or three times. We would always stand and have a chat.
Sometimes Booth and Harold chattered over ale and oysters in a Washington restaurant. Sometimes they ended up in the National Hotel talking in Booth's room. Booth gave the young man tickets to the theater and invited him into the dressing room, told him to feel free to go behind the scenery. There was no doubt about it. Young Dave Harold was stage struck. So Booth obtained an errand boy, a loyal fan, someone with a tractable mind who would do his bidding. Young Harold was fed by John Wilkes' talk of the stage, and the young man wallowed in a fledgling's fancy for the stage and the golden dreams of public applause. And so, David Harold became another strand in the web that was woven by John Wilkes. But the web is not yet complete. There are still more that will hang for the crime, some that will go to prison. Another was Dr. Samuel A. Mudd, age 32, a country physician, who lived on a small farm near Bryantown, Maryland, a stone's throw from the capital of Washington. History disagrees about the part played in the plot by this country doctor. Before this second week in April would be completed, he too would be implicated. One historian says Dr. Mudd was the most inoffensive and respectable in appearance of the Lincoln conspirators. It's a good estimate. Samuel Mudd existed as a quiet man on a quiet farm. He was a graduate of Georgetown College and the University of Maryland, but he was not an enemy of the South, and this would be his downfall. Before our story is over, he will have helped John Wilkes in a doomed effort to elude authorities. On this day in Washington, 100 years ago, the flags in the Capitol drooped in rain. Water splashed through the streets, churning the mud of Pennsylvania Avenue into a gooey paste. People huddled before the White House in damp expectancy. They were hoping that President Lincoln, inside the White Building, would make a speech of victory. The war was all but over now. The Union was the victor. Inside the White House, President Lincoln, with 3 days left to live, was tired on this night 100 years ago. He was also posing for Gardner, the photographer, and he sent word out to the crowd that he would rather not speak.
I'll speak my piece at the formal ceremonies tomorrow night, and I think any statement I might make on the subject of victory today would be considered out of place.
Now, Mr. President, if you'll just incline your head a bit forward, that's it. Now hold it.
I don't know how they stand out there in the rain like that.
Please, Mr. Lincoln, I cannot do a proper job if you keep talking like that.
Well, you see how difficult it is to get me to hold my tongue.
Really, you're no trouble at all, really. It's just that you can't be speaking when I take the picture. It would ruin it, you know. Now, this is fine. Hold your arm down just a little now and head forward just a bit. That's nice, nice. I believe this one will be the one we'll choose after all. I'll make an appointment to see you next week and we'll go over them.
No rush, Gardner. We've got plenty of time.
The last photograph ever taken of Lincoln as he lived. He would be dead 3 days from now. And as Lincoln sat for the portrait, his killer was engaged in other business. John Wilkes Booth had never been a teetotaler, but in recent days he had been drinking more heavily than usual. His taste rarely varied. He usually drank brandy, and he liked it neat, sometimes with water. And as Lincoln had his picture taken, John Booth was tilting a glass in Deary's Tavern on E Street, where it joins into Pennsylvania Avenue. The saloon was just across the street from Grover's Theater, and it attracted the theater crowd. Deary was an attraction in his own right as well. He was the national billiards champion. John Deary noticed that Booth had been acting strangely of late. He was sullen and moody, and his temper had grown unpredictable. Of course, Deary could not have known that celebrated John Wilkes was 3 days away from assassinating the President of the United States. Booth had entered the tavern at noon, 100 years ago today.
What'll it be, John Wilkes? And how are you getting along?
Give me a bottle of that brandy there and some water.
Boy, isn't the town a riot these days? Some of these folks have been celebrating about the war for more than a week now. It doesn't do business any harm, you know.
Well, it thrills me to know that you're benefiting from all of this.
And have you read the paper? The city council's ordered a big victory celebration. See, some of the local people are a little bit sick because it's been the federal government who has been taking over the show.
Well, when's the next one?
The council celebration is all set Thursday night now. Think you'd be there?
I could care less about it. Give me a little more water.
A gloomy cover of gray enshrouds Washington City this day. 100 years ago, as John Wilkes Booth tosses his brandies down and with a preoccupied look on his handsome face, listens to the babble of the barkeep. Let's shift our attention now from the E Street Saloon to a street a few blocks away. This is H Street, and occupying the number 541 is a three-story brick building with 10 rooms. It is a boarding house and is located just 4 blocks away from a playhouse frequently attended by President Lincoln. Ford's Theater, where Lincoln would be mortally wounded by an assassin 3 days from tonight. The boarding house is run by Mrs. Mary Eugenia Surratt, widow, age about 45. She, too, has a date with destiny, even as Lincoln does. Next July, on a hot afternoon, a government employee will hold an umbrella over her head and a trap will be sprung. she will be hanged for conspiracy. But at this moment, she and her boarding house wear an outward cloak of respectability.
Anne, I'm home. Come and help me with these packages, won't you?
Oh, Mother, why didn't you let me know you were going to the market? I would have come and helped you.
It wasn't that big of a chore, but there were some things I had to get. John's coming home tonight, and he's invited Mr. Booth and a friend over for a chat.
What are they going to talk about?
Don't ask such silly questions. John may be my son, but he doesn't tell me any more than any other young man his age tells his mother. I haven't been able to keep much track of that boy ever since his brother got it into his head to go to Texas and join up with the South. And after all, it isn't as if John is home much anymore, either. If he isn't sneaking down to Richmond, he's snooping around up in Montreal. I can't keep up with him.
Oh, I'd feel a lot better if he hadn't left divinity school. Here, let me help you with that. You know, John always had a funny way about him. But he's only 21 now, and... Well, a 21-year-old boy can't get into very much trouble, can he?
Daughter Anne, you'd be surprised. Very much surprised.
John Surratt, son of Mary Surratt, was a Confederate spy and a message-bearer for the underground. And although John himself would live to deliver lectures on the assassination of Lincoln, his mother would hang because of Booth's presence in her home. But until the crime would be committed, John Wilkes' visits to the Surratt boarding house did not arouse much suspicion.
Please, Mr. Booth, do try another taste of brandy. After all, we almost feel that you're one of the family.
You are much too kind, Mrs. Surratt. Perhaps I will have just a small glass more.
Fine. John, could you open that other bottle for us, please?
I don't mean to overstep my mark, Mrs. Surratt, but aren't you wearing your hair differently?
Oh, Mr. Booth, you must be joking. I haven't changed my hair in years and years.
Well, I must say then that it is most becoming. The way the light from that lamp highlights it, almost like spun ebony.
Maybe John Wilkes Booth could never forget that he was an actor, even in the presence of plump, matronly Mary Surratt. Those whom history says schemed against the life of Lincoln. Next, what actually did the plotters do? Before this week is out, 100 years ago tonight, the President of the United States will be dead. The Secretary of State will be near death. Members of his household attacked. Vice President Andrew Johnson will also be singled out for murder, but in this, the plotters will fail. But the conspirators began laying their plans long before the bullet entered the back of Lincoln's head. And there had been more than one attempt on his life, each made by Booth and his companions in crime. The scene, a long, tree-shaded lane leading to the old soldier's home in Washington. A carriage, pulled by a matched team of horses, approaches. Waiting for the carriage is Booth and his men. Their plan, to kidnap the president, who is inside the carriage.
Here it comes, men. That must be the president's carriage. Sam, you and I will head it off and take care of the driver. Payne, you and Harold grab the passenger. Cop the pistols, men!
But John, that's not the president in that carriage. See for yourself.
Let's get out of here.
Hey, what are you men up to?
We've been fooled.
That was one attempt against Lincoln's life that failed, because, as in other attempts, something went wrong. But the last attempt did not go wrong. Booth had his will and his way. But the conspirators tried more than once. Tomorrow night, on the last days of Lincoln, we'll look into the house on H Street and into the plots that history claims were concocted behind the home's closed doors. That's tomorrow night, part 3 of The Last Days of Lincoln.